in a court of law. Proposed fines are exactly that, and they are often litigated, reduced, or vacated. We use available public records, news accounts, and press releases. We cannot warranty or guarantee the details of any of the stories we share, since we are not directly involved with these stories, at least not most of the time. Enjoy the show.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
And from the border of liberty and prosperity in the highway to the north, this is Safety Wars for Thursday, April 4th, 2024. How's everybody doing? Hope everything's going okay for everybody out there. It was a busy Thursday. Trying to get my life a little bit in order here after, family emergencies and deaths and everything else over the last 4 years. Been kind of rough. Appreciate everybody. I get a lot of emails supporting me, asking what's going on. What did you think about last night's episode on tinnitus or tinnitus, as I was corrected? I say, well, hey, I'm from New Jersey, it's tinnitus. Right? The old song, right? Tonight, no, potato, potato, let's call the whole thing off, right? Some of the things, right? So, we're going to have to take a little bit of a deviation from safety tonight on one item. So, on one item, and that'll coming up. The other thing is, did you guys hear about the Parler, P-A-R-L-E-R, that was taken offline about, around 14 months ago and was bought, and now they're relaunching it. I've gotten a whole bunch of emails on here. So we're probably going to be going into Parler, and that's going to be one of our things that we're going to talk about. But, I've gotten a lot of mail, some feedback, and everything else specifically on last night's show where we went into hearing protection. And, there were some people, you should have concentrated on this a little bit more. You should have done this. You should have done that. You got all of that in there. But I thought it was very important to start the conversation specifically on hearing protection. And we're going to be, right, April 28th of this month is Worker Memorial Day. We're going to have a program on that or about then on fatalities in the workplace that go unrecorded. Well, Jim, what do you mean? You mean everyone's out there lying? No. But even according, and we had this story a couple of months ago about industrial hygiene exposures where we had OSHA, in one of their documents, state that roughly 50,000 people a year are dead, die from occupational exposures, meaning cancer, noise, radiation, things of that nature, according to their models. So, we had one person in the refining industry that I used to work with. I won't mention his name, but let's just say he was in the behavior-based safety world and used that old shame, blame, retrain type of thing, and you guys are evil because you won't work safely, and now you're impacting my personal bottom line because my bonus is based on my bonus is based on, in part by your safety performance, and you're screwing me and blah, blah, blah. At least he was honest. That's all I could say. But he always said, we're not as good as what we think we are. That was one of his things. You're not doing as well as what you think. Yeah, right. Big demotivational quote there. And what's my point? My point is this. At beginning of OSHA, 14,000 people a year died. Now, and that's who they could track per year in the workplace. Okay, fair enough. Now we're down to roughly five, and we've plateaued at five. And what our mission here at Safety FM and Safety Wars with Jay Allen and everything else, with Radar Safety Show, Todd Conklin with his show, Sam, Sheldon Primus, Alan Warford, and many others. Our purpose is to get under that 5,000. To try to take this, it would be great if we had zero, but we know that that's not realistic. So, but 55,000 people a year, right? So you have the 5,000 recordables that we know about, and then plus another 50,000. I mean, based on their models, I'm not very comfortable with that. Just not. So we'll talk about that. Now, the one thing I will talk about, and I actually have notes somewhere around here. Yep, here they are. On this was, and I know there are a lot of Star Trek fans out there. So tonight, or this morning, 3 a.m., they released, and I was not up at 3 a.m. My wife would have strangled me, getting up at 3 a.m. The season premiere of Star Trek Discovery. And yes, I am going to talk about Star Trek. It's been a huge part of my life over the last, and this is the 50th year for this. So this September 21st, marks 50 years, roughly 50 years, I've been watching Star Trek. And it started out with Star Trek, the animated series. My brother Eric and I watched that first run, 1974. And the episode was The Practical Joker. I watched the whole series back during COVID. It had won awards, but it didn't last very won an Emmy for excellence in for an excellent children's TV show. But it really wasn't geared towards children. It was a little bit cerebral. But there are people more into it than me, but I consider myself a pretty well-versed person. That I've gone to conventions, I've spoken to a lot of the stars, met a lot of people. My wife's cousin was on a couple of episodes. And so, I've gotten to know the whole world pretty well. But anyway, if you allow me this little diversion here. So last night, there was the season premiere of Star Trek Discovery. They had two episodes in there. And they introduced a lot of new things. And unfortunately, it's called the Red Directive was one of the things. But one of the things, and it does work into safety, is that they try to, on Discovery, legitimize themselves. And I'm not saying anything against the actors and actresses that have been on there. I met Mary Wiseman, who plays Lieutenant Tilly on there. Phenomenal woman. Phenomenal person. Really personal. Really liked her. I know, had a very long conversation with her one time. I'm not saying, and I tell you what, everybody who I've met, and her husband, right, also I met, everyone I met from that show, the Star Trek Discovery, have been very nice people. So this is not against them. I mean, they're good people. But what happens is they've been trying to legitimize themselves. Now you're going to say, well, Jim, how does this work into safety? That's often what we try to do is legitimize ourselves. What we're doing, well, so-and-so did this and we have to go and, go back and, relive this and relive that. And doesn't always work out. You cannot ruminate on things, or you're looking at things in the past and dwelling on them. And then it's very difficult to then create a future when you're always ruminating on the past. So you should have made a left instead of right, up instead of down, this sort of thing, right? Yes, I am quoting Captain Kirk in Star Trek V, right? But it's not healthy. And unfortunately, this series has gone back to try to legitimize themselves. So back in the original series, TOS from 66 and 69, Star Trek, the original series, they did have a race of beings called the Preservers. And then that in the next generation, in two episodes, the Arsenal of Freedom and the Chase is the main one. The Chase and was season 6, episode 20, they introduced a new species in there called the Progenitors, where allegedly this was an ancient race of people that went and seeded many worlds and created humanoids in the series. The Arsenal of Freedom was in season 1, episode 20, and this was the episode where they had a planet taken over by killer drones. Again, good sci-fi predicts the future and addresses things. Well, guess what? What are we dealing with now? Killer drones. Right? So, and it was a minor episode, but they decided this season to build, and these are the two episodes, The Red Directive today, and Under the Twin Moons, episode 2. They released two episodes today. This is what they tried to do. And I tell you what, cinematography, great. Special effects, great. Acting real well with this, right? With this thing, great people involved with this. But I don't know how successful it's going to be. Hey, I'm going to watch this Star Trek. I'm going to watch it no matter what. I don't know how successful it's going to be with them going back to these other episodes. Now, one-offs, right? Specifically, the Arsenal of Freedom and the Chase and the Next Generation. I don't know how successful that's going to be. So how do we turn with this? I enjoyed them. All right. I'll watch them again this weekend when I'm not watching WrestleMania. And with your safety program, do we try to revisit past things? One of my pet peeves, and it's just me. I mean, I don't like to, when I do something, I hate to revisit it. So I do this, I hate to revisit it. I hate to keep, that's why training sometimes is very stressful because like the Steve Martin, and I'm dating myself, when he used to be a stand-up comedian, he said, there's nothing better than repeating yourself again and again, night after night, as a stand-up comedian. And Steve Martin used to, he did a lot of acting. He was, original Saturday Night Live, that sort of thing. But anyway, he was on a lot of things. He was married to Gilda Radner, who was in the original Saturday Night Live crew. But, married to somebody else. Gilda Radner was married to Gene Wilder. I'll get yelled at for that. But anyway, just constantly revisiting stuff, ruminating things. And as I recently learned, the word ruminate, right, that's when people dwell on the past. I mean, you make a mistake, you say, okay, I made a mistake. What can I learn from that? And guess what? I'm not going to repeat that mistake. But if you go and you dwell on that mistake and let that mistake define what you're doing, you're not going to move forward on anything. And here we have, I think, they're running a big risk here on the Star Trek Discovery, and maybe with your own safety programs to rely on the past and tie things on in the past too much and rely on it. So, that's what I'm going to say on that. I'm going to come be back with the news in a minute. We're going to go to some commercials here and go with that.
In the professional safety community, communication and planning are just a few keys to your program's success. The question many practitioners have is, where do I start? Dr. Jay Allen, the creator of the Safety FM platform and host of the Rated R Safety Show, has built a global foundation to help you along the way. Go to safetyfm.com and listen to some of the industry's best and most involved professionals, including Blaine Hoffman with the Safety Pro, Sam Goodman with the Hop Nerd, Sheldon Primus with the Safety Consultant, Jim Pozell with Safety Wars, Emily Elrod with Unapologetically Bold, and many others. As individuals, we can do great things, but as a team, we become amazing. Dial into safetyfm.com today and surround yourself with a powerful force of knowledge and support.
It's Thursday, so we're having our Thursday message here. This is Safety Wars, broadcasting to our brothers and sisters in the occupied territory of behavior-based safety. Get out your secret decoder ring. Here is your nightly message.
Context drives behavior. Context drives behavior.
All right, so we're going to talk. Oh, we need one more here. We don't want to leave anybody out. OSHA recordables, catastrophic losses, environmental disasters. You want answers? So do I. This is Jim Polzel with Safety Wars.
That's my daddy.
All right, so here we have a couple of things from the Department of Labor. Let me share the screen here. Shouldn't have done that during break. Oops, sorry, guys. Screen again, having issues with the computer over doing a major computer upgrade here in the next week or so. And because this computer ain't working with some of the updated software, so we're going to be fixing that. And we're going to be changing our background here, upgrading it majorly. So here we are with, and hold on, I lost that. You got a lot of stories here, right? So this is a news release from a Department of Labor. For whatever reason, OSHA has not updated their things. This person is probably on vacation or something. Maybe they're from New York and their kids are off, like mine are. Right? So U.S. Department of Labor issues final rule to clarify rights to employee representation during OSHA inspections. This is a little bit, I have a couple of problems here with this final rule, I'll be honest with you, with this. All right. The U.S. Department of Labor today announced a final rule clarifying the rights of employees to authorize a representative to accompany an Occupational Safety and Health Administration compliance officer during an inspection of their workplace will be published in the Federal Register on April 1st. No fooling. The Occupational Safety and Health Act gives the employer and the employees the right to authorize a representative accompanying to accompany OSHA officials during workplace inspection. The final rule clarifies consistency with law. Again, there was a lawsuit here way back in the day on here, a couple years back on this, because OSHA allegedly was doing things not so good, all right? Basically not in compliance with the law. They issued regulations that were in conflict with the law. There was a lawsuit. It got settled. So they said, well, we're going to rethink this whole thing, is my understanding. So in this final rule, OSHA is amending its Representatives of Employers and Employees regulation to clarify that representatives authorized by employees may be an employee of the employer or a third party. Such third party employee representative may accompany OSHA compliance safety and health officer when, in the judgment of the CSHO, good cause has been shown why they are reasonably necessary to aid in the inspection. In the final rule, OSHA clarified that third party may be reasonably necessary because of their relevant knowledge, skills, or expertise with hazards or conditions in the workplace or similar workplaces, or language or communication skills. Okay, language or communication skill, I can understand that. Right, so they're speaking an unusual dialect of Spanish, Chinese, perhaps a European language. Okay, I get that. You need an interpreter or something like that. Or maybe you're dealing with an at-risk population, like people are autistic, people are deaf, right? So you need someone, a sign language person in there. So, yeah, that's fine. That makes sense here. OSHA concluded that these clarifications aid OSHA's workplace inspections by better enabling employees to select their representatives of their choice to accompany a CSHO. Okay, well, I could choose like a union representative or maybe someone else, a trusted person. Okay, good. Employee representation during the inspection is critically important. The effective rule is May 31st, 2024. Now, there's a lot of stuff out there on this. All right. With this is the whole policy here. There's a lot of comments on this going on online, and you could go and you could look them up. I mean, there's many, many different. No, everybody has a comment, right? Everybody has a comment here. I'm going to give mine in a minute here. Since the Occupational Safety Health Act was passed in 1907, Section 8 of the OSHA Act has required that subject to regulations issued by the Secretary of Labor, a representative, and going on with that. However, the regulation also created an exception for a third party who's not an employee of the employer when in the adjustment, right, needs to do that. The regulation pointed to two non-exhaustive examples, a safety engineer and an industrial hygienist. While OSHA has long permitted employee representatives to be third parties, in 2017, a district court concluded that interpretation was not consistent with the regulation because the first sentence, 1903.8, explicitly stated that employee representatives shall be employees of the employer. It rejected OSHA's interpretation that flatly contradicting the regulation has a case here. However, the district court also recognized that OSHA's interpretation that third parties could be employee representatives was a persuasive and valid reading. The court concluded that the act merely provides the employee's representatives must be authorized by the employees, not the representative must also be an employee of the employer. You can see what the problem here is, my opinion. The final rule has a narrow purpose and makes changes to 1903.8. First, in response to the district court's decision, it clarifies that consistent with Section 8 of the OSHA Act, employee representatives may either be an employee of the employer or a third party. Second, consistent with OSHA's longstanding practice, it clarifies that a third-party representative authorized by employees may have a variety of skills, knowledge, or blah, blah, blah that could aid the inspection. The latter revision clarifies employees' options for third-party representation. Right, OSHA has retained the longstanding requirement that third-party representatives may accompany the CSHO. So, basically, it all lies on your compliance officer as to whether or not this person could be allowed on. And it does make a it does make an exception that the requirement that the conduct of the inspections preclude unreasonable disruption in the operations of the employer's establishment or the employer's right to limit entry of employee-authorized representatives into areas of the workplace that contain trade secrets. My question is this, my comment. An employee, so-and-so who's a direct hire of a company, that's easy. They get hurt as a workers' comp issue. They get exposed to something, workers' comp issue. There's a problem, workers' comp issue. What if they're getting some people that are a private consultant that by law do not have to have a workers' comp insurance? And if you're a consultant like me, in most states, I'm not even covered by workers' comp, but I'm required by contract to keep it to have workers' comp. What happens? What happens if the employer is not liked by this third party that OSHA brings in or the employees authorize? It's an adversarial relationship. Now, how's that going to work? How's it going to work? If this person then goes, and again, things do not have to be a registered trade secret here. You could go into a facility, see people working, and say, maybe I could go and apply this and sell this to somebody else, maybe their competitor. Maybe that third party is going to be working for your competitor. Hey, you're going over to Acme Machine Shop over there? Maybe you want to go over there and check out what they're doing over there. Right? And contrary view is, well, everybody's professional. Oh, okay, everyone's professional. No, you cannot unsee certain things in the workplace. This is where my problem with that is, and I could see more lawsuits here, and that's more than That's more than what I, no, that's above my pay grade there. I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to play one here on the radio here. But I can say, yeah, okay, third party, but I think there's details that need to be worked out. How's this going to be worked out contractually? Right? Do you know, do you meet someone somewhere? Hey, oh, yeah, Frank down at such and such a place. He's an expert on this. So let's get him involved. Now there are supporting documents from the field operations manual and some other stuff in here that probably would clarify some of this, but I still have questions. I don't now letting somebody into a workplace that is that that's not a compliance officer. Compliance officers have the right and the responsibility. Yeah, I get it. Or that getting in there, I don't know if that's such a good idea all the times, right? Now, so the rule, so in summary, right, the rule is in part a response to a court decision ruling the agency's existing regulation only permitted employees of the employer to be authorized representatives. However, the court acknowledged that the OSHA Act does not limit who can serve as an employee representative, and OSHA's historic practice was a persuasive and valid construction of the OSHA Act. Today's final rule is a culmination notice and comment of rulemaking. Okay, so we got that straightened out, I hope, or we are all more confused more than ever. Now, I was also contacted today. And someone said, Jimmy, maybe you should comment on this. You have, but maybe you should go into a little bit more in depth with this. So there was a proposed rule. I have the Federal Register right here up on the screen. Hold on. So here we go. All right. Hold on, let me get the setting right. All right, so let's make sure this is showing. Okay, so here we have the actual proposed rule right out of the Federal Register, 29 CFR Part 1910, Emergency Response Standard Proposed Rule. Department of Labor, right, and this is the proposed rule. So under the emergency response standard, my problem was with this, sovereign immunity. Always has been my problem. That's been a running theme of this show is, a government should be, right, OSHA regulation should be applied to the government, right? So this is in 1910 standard in general industry. So OSHA is proposing through this notice of proposed rulemaking to issue a new safety and health standard titled Emergency Response to replace the existing fire brigade standard. The new standard would address a broader scope of emergency responders and would include programmatic elements to protect emergency responders from a variety of occupational hazards. The agency requests comments on all aspects of the proposed rules, and this is until May 6th. You can go and publicly comment on this. And remember, they do become part of the record when you do that. And you could go and look this up where you could do this. So what is this? Scrolling on down. So elements of the emergency responder, firefighters, emergency medical service providers, and technical search and rescue services, health and safety are currently regulated by OSHA primarily under a patchwork of hazard-specific standards and by state regulations and state with OSHA-approved state plan programs. While OSHA standards do not apply to volunteers, some volunteers are covered in states with OSHA-approved state plan programs. I've gotten had conversations many times over the years from volunteer organizations that say, well, we don't have to comply with OSHA and screw our people. I've had that happen. Yeah, I have. I know that's going to offend some people, but I'm telling the truth here. Well, they are volunteers, so we don't have to worry about anything. So it's like, okay, so you don't have to worry about respiratory protection for a firefighter. You don't have to worry about medical clearance for a firefighter. You don't have to worry about this for a fire. Oh, no, we don't. We're volunteers. We're not covered by anything. Okay, great. You know, all of the OSHA standards referred to above were promulgated decades ago, and none was designed as a comprehensive emergency response procedure standard. Consequently, they do not address the full range of hazards currently facing emergency responders, nor do they reflect major changes in performance specification for protective clothing and equipment or major improvements in safety and health practices that have already been accepted by emergency response community and incorporated into industry consensus standards. Notably, the OSHA standards do not align with the Department of Homeland Security's Incident Management System, NIMS, which guides all levels of government, non-governmental organizations, and the private sector to work together to prevent, protect against, mitigate, respond to, and recover from emergency incidents. So, in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, all government agencies, including OSHA, were directed to strengthen their preparedness. So, this is where the disaster worker training came into being, right? It might have been before 2001, but they really stressed it over the years, and I'm an authorized trainer for that. Now, 7.5 and 15 hours. It used to be 8 and 16, but they made it 7.5 and 15. So it only took them 23 years, 22 years, right, after this, right? Right? Going on and on. What's the meat of this? Background. And we're taking you right through the Federal Register. And let's go through the actual text. And we're scrolling on down. Scrolling on down. Talking about injured people, injured firefighters, things of that nature. SCBAs, respiratory protection. Opioid-related exposure, right? So you're responding to an emergency with that, right? And a lot of front matter here, but that's how this goes. NFPA references, National Fire Protection Association references. We're going to scroll down. Legal authority. Best available evidence. And here's the proposed section. So here we have section 1910, 120, hazardous waste operations, right? Emergency response, respiratory protection, 134. Okay. Section 1910.155, scope application definitions applicable to this part. And it goes through there where we have updated stuff here. Going on and on. Let's get down to the actual stuff. All right, hold on. You know what I'm gonna do? Here you go. Okay. And you get to the end and it talks specifically, here is the standard. I'm sorry about that. So let's scroll on back. This is live show. Okay. So 1910-156, emergency response. This section applies to employers that have a workplace emergency response team as defined in paragraph B. Employees on the team as a collateral duty to the regular daily work assignments respond to emergency incidents to provide service such as firefighting, EMS, technical search and rescue. For the purposes of this section, this type of employer is called a workplace emergency response employer. The team is called a WERT, workplace emergency response team. Employers that are emergency service organizations as defined in paragraph B, right, that's where the scope is on here. This employee section does not apply to employers performing disaster site cleanup or recovery duties following natural disasters and activities covered by 1910-120 or 1910-146. All right, combustion, and then it goes through the all of the definitions here. Nothing really comes up, right? It does, well, except for this. Emergency response program means a written program developed by the WER or ESO to ensure that the WER and or ESO is prepared for a safety to respond to and operate an emergency incident. What also has to be in there? A communications plan. Probably not in here, but you need that. See Monday show. Going in here. An incident action plan means the incident objectives, strategy, and tactics necessary to manage an incident. The IAP is developed at the incident site and provides essential information for actionable incident organization, work assignments, management of resources, risk management, and team member or responder safety when operating an incident. So this would likely be some type of a very detailed JHA or THA or JSA, whatever we're calling them this week. Incident management system, again, it includes establishing functions for managing incidents, describes roles and responsibilities going on there, and all our other definitions. So, again, and it describes in detail exactly what you're going to need. You're in the emergency response plan. So you're going to assess, analyze, and act, the AAAs. And going through your previous editions of ERP documents required by this section shall be maintained by the WER for a minimum of 5 years. And you have different assessments that have to be obtained. So that's it in a nutshell. You have to have assess your hazards, analyze them, and act. Write a plan. You don't want to go and this is a living document. It gets updated. Bottom line, have a plan. Now, what has to be in the emergency risk management plan? The risk management plan. Several things. You know, you have to have the activities, training, the activities at the facility, normal activities, training, vehicle operations, operations at emergency incidents. So you have to go and figure out what your emergency incidents are, non-emergency services and activities that lead to combustion products, carcinogens, and other incident-related health hazards. We're going to talk more about that in a minute here. Includes at a minimum PPE, and this is all different stuff for industrial hygiene in that section. The three I's, right? PPE, 1910-134 respiratory protection plan, bloodborne pathogens, and also in policy for extraordinary situations. The WER and ESO shall review the RMP when reviewing is required. Medical and physical requirements. This is where most organizations fail, especially after COVID, for whatever reason, since a lot of organizations and a lot of groups stopped doing routine physicals for stuff, right? Because you have to do spirometry, you have to do fit test. A lot of facilities stopped doing them, but they never restarted. And now you got people like me coming in. Hey, Jim, can you do a fit test? I said, yeah. Did your people go into a? Did you get people go through a medical evaluation? No, but you can do a fit test. I said, I ain't doing a fit test. Why don't you call up my buddy and get a medical clearance here, so we don't have an issue here? Because right, so medical evaluation. We talked about tinnitus last night, or tinnitus, and the importance of, if you're an employee or an employer, getting a baseline, a medical evaluation upon hiring. And this is the other one, short post-crisis, right, stuff. We talk about psychological issues on these jobs. Very important. And that's what I had to say about that. Let's take a little break here, and we will get back to you.
Have you listened or watched the Safety War show? It does stream live on the radio and on the streamers that we have. So if you have not taken a listen to Jim Bozell and what the hell he's doing every evening with Safety Wars, I would strongly encourage you to take a view or take a listen, whichever option is available for you, and take a listen to what the hell he has going on. It's definitely, it will take some deep dives and some information that you might be interested in.
In a world where danger lurks in every corner, one man stands as a beacon of hope. Jim Bozell, a veteran safety expert with over 3 decades of experience, now bringing his knowledge to you with Safety Wars. Engaging, informative, and always relevant, that's Safety Wars. Join the safety revolution with Safety Wars, available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts and videos.
All right, so it's going to be, well, why, Jim, why are we doing this? Why are we going over this? This letter of interpretation is going to be going out to my clients tomorrow. And I don't have permission to call. I normally don't call out people for things, especially if they're on a competing network. But this letter of interpretation is from a person who has a podcast, a pretty good one, a very old podcast, too. He's a labor law attorney. I believe I met him one time at some event. I don't recall that sort of thing. I shared a story today, and I'm full of stories where I was at a checkout line. And there was a person behind me with one item in a food store, and I let her go in front of me, and she was very appreciative and started asking me questions as to why I was in Montana. And I said, well, I'm doing environmental cleanup out here, Mission Y in Montana, blah, blah, blah. And she was, no, that was one of her things, was the environment. And then she walks out of the store. She thanks me for doing the cleanup, walks out of the store. And a woman says, you know who you just spoke to? And I said, no, she looked familiar, but you know, I work with a lot of different people. And, you know, and she said, well, that was Marco Kidder, Lois Lane from the Superman movies. So I meet a lot of different interesting people. This past week, I met Peter Griffin, the real Peter Griffin, who, if you're into Fortnite, like a lot of children are, he's one of the Fortnite people. Right. And they're on TikTok. But anyway, we meet different people. But this is written by an attorney went in for some clarification. And this is actually a really important clarification on the regulation. Right. So record keeping obligations under 1910-146, confined space entry, general industry standard. Now, here it says, in your letter, you discussed, and this is from OSHA, the documentation requirements in 29 CFR 1910-146 for permits that include, among other information, the results of the employer's testing within the confined space for atmospheric hazards. All right. Whenever, so you have normally four nowadays. Used to be less. So you have oxygen, which is the most important, because without oxygen, the air monitoring equipment may not work effectively because you have what is called, especially with a lower explosive limit or lower flammable limit detector, you have what is called the Wheatstone Bridge. And that Wheatstone Bridge does not operate without enough oxygen. So oxygen is the most important, and the other sensors on the real-time equipment may not work. So without enough oxygen, and general industries and construction, it's 19.5 to 23.5% oxygen in that. If you're on a ship in a shipyard in 1915, then it's 19.5 to 22% oxygen in the confined and enclosed spaces regulation. So, and confines the oxygen, flammable gases, vapors, and then potential toxic air contaminants. So usually this breaks down as oxygen, LEL, H2S, and CO, carbon monoxide, right? H2S, hydrogen sulfide, whenever any employee is exposed to the atmosphere in the space. Now, You noted that Section 1910.146 requires you employers to maintain canceled entry permits for at least 1 year. You also referenced a previous OSHA letter of interpretation issued on November 26, 1996, which stated that those results would show the composition of an atmosphere to which an employee is actually exposed, even if the employee is using a respirator. Our records under 29 CFR 1910.1020, which imposes a retention time of 30 years. So here we have some three scenarios listed here. First one is that the toxic substance is below 25% of the PEL, right? Or TLV. Scenario number two is, right? So it's not, doesn't exceed. Scenario number two is that initial monitoring data reveals concentrations of toxic substances below 25% of any applicable PEL or TLV. The employee is therefore permitted to enter the confined space using appropriate respiratory protection. Atmospheric levels for toxic substances subsequently exceed 25% of the PEL, but do not exceed a PEL or TLV at some time during the employee's entry in the confined space. As a result, the employee is immediately removed, the space is stabilized, right? And using forced air ventilation, the confined space is then retested, and the employee re-enters the proper respiratory protection once the levels drop below 25%. Thus, at no time during this his or her entry were the atmospheric levels in excess of the PEL or TLV. Any substances above 25% of any applicable PEL or TLV. The space is then stabilized using forced air ventilation, and the confined space is retested. The employee is then permitted to enter them with proper respiratory protection once the levels drop below 25% of the PEL or TLV. I'm going to translate this into a couple of sentences. As safety professionals, we are required, right? You should. When you're setting thresholds for atmospheric monitoring in any environment, you put in a safety margin. So usually, rule of thumb, safety margin is 2-1, meaning half. So if your PEL is 100, your action level is 50 because it's 2-1 safety margin, right? You're dividing it in half. Right. I don't know if that's the way you say it, but it's half. Right. Well, so what these folks are doing is someone made the decision that it's going to be a quarter for whatever reason. Doesn't matter. Depends on a lot of stuff. Right. Out there. I'm not doing the assessment. So it's a quarter, meaning 1/4, meaning that you're not exceeding 25% of anything. So here's the question. Under each of the above scenarios, does OSHA consider the initial monitoring data, subsequent retesting data to constitute employee exposure records subject? So do you need to retain those things for 30 years? Because I tell you what, most places where I go, I tell them, and I've always told them, hey, you got to maintain these for 30 years. I know that they're going to take this stuff and throw it in the garbage. Right after the job is done, after that 1 year, they're going to throw it out if it lasts that long. The exposure monitoring requirements and OSHA's permit required confined spaces standard are intended to document the permit record and either the absence of acute atmospheric hazards, meaning short term, during employee entries, or an increase of an acute atmospheric hazard requires removal of the entrance. These atmospheric hazards include asphyxiation, explosion, and toxic gases, vapors, or mists. They're immediately dangerous to life and health and pose immediate or delayed within 72 hours. That is an acute hazard within 72 hazards, threats to life, irreversible adverse health effects, or any effects that would interfere with an individual's ability to escape unaided from space, going on and on. We're going on, and we got 9 minutes left here. OSHA's regulation, access to employees' right medical exposures, right, 30 years. With respect to the three scenarios described, this is the meat of it. With respect to the three scenarios described in your letter, the definition of employee exposure record in 1910.10.1 120 includes records concerning the workplace monitoring or measuring of a toxic substance or harmful physical agent, including personal area, grab, wipe, or other forms of sampling. Right? The regulation states that toxic substance or harmful physical agent means any chemical substance, biological, or physical stress, which is the listed and the latest printed edition of the NIOSH Registry for Toxic Substances, which is RTEX, right? Registry of Toxic Effects and Toxic Substances, which is incorporated by reference, has yielded positive evidence of an acute or chronic health hazard. So if it's listed in that document positive, you got to, right, with that. And it goes on and it says this. Employers, from that, no, we won't belabor it. Employers have to retain all those confined space entry monitoring records, which most employers don't, right? Unless they have a health and safety professional on staff, they don't maintain them. But all those meter readings that you're collecting have to be maintained for 30 years. Bottom line, according to this letter of interpretation, as I read it. My question is, how the hell are you going to do it? Well, we'll do it electronically. Oh, is that really reliable? Let's say 15 years. Now, this couple, let's do a complete circle. We're going to completely circle this around to what we mentioned at the beginning. This OSHA, according to their models, has stated on record, we've covered it on this show, that 50,000 people a year are dying because of workplace industrial hygiene issues, like exposures to atmospheric hazards in this. They've stated this. Where's this going? If they have stated this, can someone who gets some kind of illness later on, many different occupational illnesses that are deadly, can they now go and say, hey, I worked for this company, ABC company, in 2024, it's now 2040, and that big safety guy out there who was out there wore those orange shirts and you had that crazy podcast. He went out there and he said that there was possible this out there, and he was out there doing benzene drawing things. What are they called? Dragon tubes, Draeger tubes, colorimetric tubes, something. And then they go back, and hopefully, you know, I'll be down with Jay Allen enjoying Cabo St. Lucas, right? No, Sammy Hagar and Van Halen tribute concerts. Maybe out at St. John's on the beach. You know, U.S. Virgin Islands. I don't know. We'll be down there. And we're going to get a phone call. Hey, Jimmy. Hey, did you on this site back in 2024? Yeah. Where the hell are all your monitoring records? I don't know. I gave them to the company. Oh, can you prove that? Oh, by the way, now we're going to be suing your ass. We're going to cause you a problem. Could happen. So, guess what? And they said, well, you know what? I think I remember that meter going off. Blah, blah, blah. What was that? I was exposed to something. I could see that happening. So, this is actually very important. Letter of interpretation. They're all important, but this is really an important one if you do any type of monitoring in a permit-required confined space. And what else are they going to check? We covered this also. Calibration records. Qualifications of the person. All of this stuff has to be worked in there. What are their qualifications? What are the, you know, what? How are we going to retain these records? What are we going to do? All this stuff has to go in. And by the way, this is where your accountability logs come into. Your log in and then your log out of permit required confined spaces. Who was there? Did they go into that space? Did they come out of that space? Extremely important that stuff gets recorded and everything else. So this is what I want you to do. I want you to take this little section. I might edit this out and put it as a standalone. We'll see how it goes. And you want to use this as a safety meeting for your people. So, and as I say to anybody I had to supervise, this is what the standard is. If I am not meeting the standard or you have questions, please ask me what's going on. Please do it. And it's like, well, I don't feel comfortable with it. And I'm like, I don't care if you feel comfortable or not. Do it anyway. Why? Because there's a war for your safety. There's a war for your safety. This is one of the battles that you have to fight in that safety war that we're talking about. Making sure the safety professional does their job. Making sure the company does their job. If you're a union representative, I mean, I go out on union projects and they're like, what the hell is that, Jimmy? That's called a docking station for calibrating air monitoring equipment. Well, since when do we calibrate air monitoring equipment every day? Since I've been doing this in 1992. Oh, really? Wow. But anyway, that's what I got for tonight here on Safety Wars. You know, that's just the way it is. And we'll see you tomorrow, God willing. For Safety Wars and for the Safety FM Network, have a great night. And, of course, have a great night. Let me hit the other button.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.